Okay, so the topic that I wanted to discuss is the question of what people do on Pesach if they have any sort of gluten wheat sensitivity. Obviously, the most extreme being celiac, where people cannot have any gluten whatsoever. But there's also varying levels where people can have a little, and it gives them a stomach ache and things like that. So what exactly do we do? And the reason I wanted to do it is because, at least on the question of oats, which is one of the essential suggestions of how to deal with it, there are a lot of methodological points to take in mind. So, I don't know if you've seen it. I assume you have. But every year, if you go and you try to buy matzah, so there's a normal matzah, a normal machine matzah, a normal hand matzah, but there's the super, super expensive oat matzah for people who are incapable of having wheat or having gluten, okay? So where does this come from, and does it work as matzah? So there's a few issues here. But let's outline where this comes from and then highlight some of the potential problems. So the Mishnah in Psachim, the second parak, tells you that Elu dvarim shadam yotei b'hen yidei chavato b'pesach, v'chitim v'sarim v'kusmin v'shifon v'shibolet shual. There are five grains that you can use for matzah on Pesach. Chitim is pretty much unarguably wheat. Sarim is pretty much not argued to be barley. Kusmin shifon, so oats and spelt, not oats and spelt, sorry, rye and spelt, not in that order, and then shibolet shual, which might or might not be oats. In halacha we pask in this way as well. Elu dvarim she yotzim bam yedei chova matzah. However, as you see, the minog is to take lechatchila chitim. And the Mishnah Berurah says, why is it there's a minog to only use wheat? So he says, mishum devechaviv la'adam bioter, because they're the best, people enjoy them, v'ikam mishum hedor mitzvah. And it's a hedor mitzvah, it's a more beautiful way of doing the mitzvah. V'minog chitim, yikach but if you don't have wheat, you can use the other four grains, whichever one you want, like, more. So, the first question of whether you could use, let's say, not wheat. Okay, let's assume for a minute that shuvot shuval is oats. So the answer to that is clearly yes. Right? I mean, on that level, yes. There may be a minhag to only use wheat, because it's the best, but as David Cohn notes here in his celiac, a guide to mitzvah observance, right, a celiac who is unable to eat wheat matzah would clearly be permitted to bake and eat oat matzah. Because if it's just that it's the best, okay, it's a minhag to use wheat, because people like wheat better than they like whatever, so obviously that's not going to be an obstacle if someone is incapable of having wheat. It's better that they should fulfill the mitzvah. He does note, however, Marsham suggests the second reason for the minhag is based on the Gemara, which indicates that chimutz process for some grains is different than for wheat, and that we should therefore only bake matzah from the grain which we have the most experience. Right? The Marsham says the reason there was a minhag to only use wheat is because since we have the most experience with the wheat, we know how it rises, and we can make sure that it doesn't become chametz. And based on this, the Minchas Yitzchak felt that under no circumstances should you make matzah from things other than wheat. However, as Rav David Cohen here notes, from Ray Kestenbaum, who's been like the real force behind the creation of oat matzahs, when he told Diane Weiss that there are some people who really can't eat gluten under any circumstances, he said, then if really, really, really you can't eat it, right, you're really allergic, which apparently he originally didn't realize that people were so allergic, then you could have non-wheat matzah. Okay? So the first potential obstacle to having oat matzah, this minhag to have wheat, doesn't seem to be a problem for people who actually can't have wheat at all, can't have gluten at all. That's the first potential problem. The second potential problem is as follows. Oats are usually heat treated before they're stored. Now, what's the problem with heat treating the oats? They can't become chametz. So why might that be a problem? So the reason it might become a problem is because if you look at the Gemara in number 5, the Gemara first defines all of the 5 grains, and then in the second line is the Minani Mili. Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, v'chein tana de beir Rabbi Yishmael, v'chein tana de beir Elazar ben Yaakov. Amar kra lo tochal alav chamet shivat yamim tochal alav matzot, dvarim habayim lidei chimut, adam yotzei bahen yidei chovato b'masa, yatsu elu, she'ein bain lidei chimut el lidei sirchon. The only things that can become matzah are things that, if they rise too much, become chametz. In the Yerushalmi, however, there are 2 formulations of this principle. So the Mishnah in the Yerushalmi in challah, because challah has the same rules as matzah, says as follows: Chamishes varim chayevim b'challah. K'tiv v'yaba chalchem milechem ha'aretz tarimu truma l'Hashem. Yachol, you call it varim chayavim b'challah. You might have thought all everything is chayim b'challah. Tamad lomer milechem, v'lo kol lechem. Not all bread in milechem, v'lo kol lechem. Ein le'alachid v'sorer bilvad. So then the Yerushalmi says, well, if I'm limiting some grains, maybe I should limit it to only wheat and barley. Kus min shibalat shuel v'shifon minayin. How about the other 3 grains? Tamad lomer reshita risotechem riba hakol. So once it establishes by challah, so then Rabbi Yosef Hashem Rishimon Tani Rabbi Shmuel Ben Rabbi Yona Rabbi Zeir Hashem Ben Lakish Hashem Rabbi Shmuel Amri Mana Azut LeKesaren V'Shamet Rabbi Achva V'Rabbi Zeira V'Abay Hava Amr LeBishem Rabbi Shmuel Omer Nomar Lechem BePesach Nemar Lechem BePesach Nemar Lechem BeChallah. We use the phrase bread lechem on Pesach and the mitzvah challah. Ma lechem Shnemar BePesach Davar Shubali De Matzah Uchametz. Just like lechem by Pesach means something that could either become chametz or matzah, av lechem shnemar b'challah davar shubali de matzah u chametz. Ubadku matzu she'en lechaba lide matzah v'chametz el chametz shel aminim bilvad, and they discovered that the only grains that can rise in that way are the 5 grains. Now in the Yerushalmi, one of the positions, one of the explanations is like what we have in the Bavli, namely that the standard for what makes something a grain for the purpose of matzah is that it could become chametz. But there's a second drasha, which is that only something made of these 5 grains is defined as lechem. Now, what might the difference be? So there's the Rishonim had the following debate. Everyone agrees that at some level, what is used for matzah must have the potential to become chametz. But the Rambam and the Ramban seem to argue as to whether that's a definitional question or a practical question. Meaning, is it that the species that could become chametz can be used for matzah, whether or not the particular wheat you are using is capable of becoming chametz, or is it that the particular grains you're using have to have the potential as you're baking them to be matzah if you bake them short enough, and chametz if you let them rise, right? So again, is it that it's giving you the definition of the right species, right? The species that can rise can be used for matzah, and species that don't rise cannot be used for matzah, or is it that the grain you're actually using to make matzah has to become chametz? Why does that matter? So as Reb David Cohen notes in 9, I won't read it, but he says, the nafka mina is very simple. If you think that it's about grains, so assuming oats in theory could rise, they could be used for matzah. But since most oats are heat-treated, and therefore will never rise, then if you use heat-treated oats, and you think that not only does the species used for matzah have to be capable of becoming chametz, but the particular grains you're using have to be able to be used for have to be able to become chametz, so then you would not be able to use oats. And you know, this seems to be machlokes mishonim, right? Look at the Ramban in Melchamot. The Ramban focuses on the imbalo mayim tepukle mishum shakol shein obali lidei chimut and yotzin bo matza. Right, the Ramban seems to say that it's practical. The grain you use must actually be able to become chametz. However, according to the Rambam, it sounds not that way. It sounds like it's about species. How do we know? Because the Rambam says that matzah shalosha b'mei peirot yotza b'idei chovato b'pesach. That matzah, which is made of fruit juice, which according in Chazal felt that if something was made purely with fruit juice or oil or the like, it could not rise. It's still kosher for matzah. It just can't be used day or night because of lechem oni, right? Because of other reasons, it's too rich. It's matzah shira. But fundamentally, though, even according to the Rambam, even if you make matzah out of wheat, but you do it in such a way that it won't rise by using only oil and no water, so then it is permitted. So what it seems like is that the Rambam believes that when we say that matzah must have the potential to become chametz, it means that the species that make chametz are the same species used for matzah, and therefore even heat-treated oats would potentially be able to be used for matzah. And the Ramban says, no, the grain you actually use to make matzah must have the potential to become chametz, and therefore oats, which are heat-treated, would not be able to be used. Now, how do we paskin? So many of the Achronim, the Prima Gadim, Shulchan Aruch Harav, are strict like the Ramban. The Chayei Adam is making like the Rambam, and says that B'Shar HaTzchak, if it's necessary, you can paskin like the Rambam. So what does that mean for oat matzah? The post can assume that, look, even if you want to be machmir like the Ramban, if someone is really celiac and can't have any gluten, so then the Rambam is good enough to rely on for these purposes. Now, it is true that this used to be a problem, but is less of a problem because some of the newer factories are trying to use not heat-treated oats. But the second potential obstacle also seems to be surmountable. Okay? So far, the two potential obstacles to using oat matzah. One is the minhag to only use wheat. That seems to be surmountable if you can't, for medical reasons, have wheat. The second issue of whether or not you have to use the species that can become chametz, or actually grain that can become chametz, again, that's surmountable because according to the Rambam, it's always fine as long as the right species, and if you can find oats that are not heat-treated, then everyone would agree that it's fine. The biggest problem, though, and this is the most methodologically interesting one, and this is the one I wanted to focus on, is the question of whether oats are shibolat shuel at all. Okay? So, I'm sure that growing up, when you learned the five grains, were you taught that shibolat shuel, that oats were one of the five grains? Yeah. Where does that come from? So it turns out that it's a machloket. Rashi and Rabbi Gershom both translate shibolat shuel as avena, right? Avena, which is oats. Okay? However, the Rambam in Perish of Mishnayot, and the Lekit Yosher, and Rabbi Natan Ave Yeshiva in his commentary of the Mishnah, all claim that it is not oats. Shibolat Shual are instead two-road barley, segala. Why did they say it was segala? Now, if you see 10, you see the Aruch, right? Perish segala, v'yesh omrim, ha'v'yasui kazanav shual. Now, why was there such a machloket? So let's try to figure out why you would debate it. So if you look at number 11,
The Mishnah and Kilayim is trying to figure out which grains are considered Kilayim with each other. So it says, Achitim v'hazunen in Kilayim zebizeh. Chitim and this grain, Zunin, are not Kilayim because Zunin is essentially a different subspecies of wheat. Haseorim v'shibolet shu'al. Hakusmin v'ashifon apol v'atabir v'abrukon v'atok v'apol alavan shu'in enim Kilayim zebizeh. And these are all pairs. So Seorim and Shibolet Shual are not Kilayim in each other. Now what does that imply about the relationship between Seorah and Shibolet Shual? The Shibolet Shual is a subspecies of barley. So that's one reason to believe that it's Segala, right, this two-rowed barley, and not oats. Another reason, look at the Yerushalmi in 12, Shura, Zeh Shibolet Shual. Shibolet Shual is called Shura. Why? V'loma nikra shma Shura, she'asuya kishura. Why is it called Shura? Because it is a line. So now I want you to look at the picture in 10 on the left-hand side, okay? Look at all the grains here that are definitely part of the five grains. So on the top right corner, it's a little bit small, but you see wheat, you see chita. Okay? Underneath it, on the right-hand side, you have kusmin, and right next to it, you have shifon, right? So Ryan spelt. In the top left-hand corner, you have sora, you have barley. Do you see how all of them look similar? Okay, good. Now, look at the bottom. In the middle, you have shibolet shual 1. You have segala. And in the bottom left corner, you have oats. Which of those does not look like the others? Yes, the oats, when you simply look at it, doesn't look the same. And remember, the Yerushalmi called it rose. Which of these looks like it grows in rows? Yeah, the segala, right? The two-rowed barley, not the oats. So the evidence builds that the Mishnah tells you that it's a subspecies of barley. It looks, right, two-rowed barley really looks like barley. It looks like the other grains, and oats doesn't look like any other grain. Now, there's another problem, and this comes to the heart of the issue, and that's the following. Why is it that people can use oats even if they are celiac? Because they don't have gluten. That should raise some alarms there, because what makes the grains is that they rise. What makes them rise is gluten. The fact that oats don't have gluten means that they don't rise in the way that the other grains do. Now, that's very convenient if you think that one of the five grains doesn't have gluten. But if I was just asking you in a vacuum, do you think that something that doesn't have gluten is one of the grains which is defined by its ability to rise? You know, that's a little bit problematic. So what happens? So this issue exploded when Professor Yehuda Felix, who was the Jewish botanist and zoologist par excellence, and he wrote endless books on Jewish botany and zoology, pointed this out to several poskim, including Rosh Hashanah Zalman Orbach, and argued that oats are probably not the proper definition of shibolet shu'al. Rabbi Breut summarizes this in number 13, right? And he says, furthermore, the translation of the term shibolet shu'al to oats is difficult for many technical reasons that are related to the scientific description of shibolet shu'al found in the Gemara. The Gemara states directly that whatever exactly shibolet shual is, it's a subspecies of barley, and this is cited by many Rishonim. Oats is clearly not a part of the barley family. It is a distinct species of grain, unlike segala, which is a form of barley. Segala and barley crossbreed, and oats and barley do not. Furthermore, the Mishnah Kilayim indicates that shibolet shual and shifon and barley can all crossbreed, which is simply false for oats, but true for segala. The ability to crossbreed is explicitly codified in Shulchan Aruch, Yoredeya 297.14. And just the classification of Otis Shavuot Shul is inconsistent with the text of Shulchan Aruch. Indeed, if one looks at the plants and the grains themselves, it is clear that oats do not even look like barley, unlike segula, which does. Furthermore, the Jerusalem Talmud Challah states that Shavuot Shul grows in a row, which is consistent with the definition of segula, also known as two-row barley, and not for oats. One can say with some confidence that oats simply do not fit the botanical description found for Shavuot Shul in the Mishnah, Talmud, Shulchan Aruch, or later codes. This fact casts significant doubt on the correctness of the definition of many Rishonim who translate Shavuot Shul into Latin and call it avena, or oats, and it further inclines me to think that Rambam is correct that Shavuot Shul has to be a subspecies of barley. No less a contemporary authority than Sternbach and Chuvanago notes that our oats, which he calls Quakers, are not Shavuot Shul, a vote seconded by Yad Chanoch. It is, of course, true that tradition found in the Achronim to identify oats as the fifth grain, such as Hayada, Mishnah Berurah, Shaar HaTzion, or HaShulchan, is the common one of the last centuries and perhaps reflects the distance Jews have socially experienced from many agrarian matters for centuries. I'll get to its conclusion in a second, okay? But this is basically a summary of Professor Felix's arguments, which is there are many reasons to think that it is not one of the five grains. So what happened? And here's where I want to talk about methodology. What do you do? Okay? The minhag for hundreds of years has been to treat oats as one of the five grains. Based on Rashi, based on, right? But the simple pshat in Yerushalmi and a little bit more familiarity with the grains, which, to be fair, Rashi may not have had access to, tells you that it's probably not. So what do you do methodologically? So I'll be honest, if you had asked me, I would have said methodologically, this is a no-brainer. Right? My conclusion would have been that we should reject Rashi and say that oats are not Shavuot Shul, instead it's two-row barley. Now, why do I say that? Because I don't think this is a controversial statement. Because there's a huge machloket in the post-game as to whether you can overturn, let's say, classic understandings of halacha based on a manuscript or something like that, or archaeology. I understand that machloket, because you might say that, look, hashgacha guided the hand of psak, or halacha, like any other legal system, requires a certain level of stability, and things like that. I get that. But if you had asked me to guess, I would have said that this is not that. Why is this not the same? First of all, it's a misunderstanding of facts. And there's another reason, which is... Yeah, very good. It's like, this is not like you're coming with a manuscript or some archaeology or some new fangled science to uproot the entire tradition of Psak. All you're doing is saying that with the information available to us, the Rambam seems more likely than Rashi. That doesn't seem to me like a super controversial, modernish imposition of, like, academic Torah, right? Like, the academy on the, like, if you asked me to guess, I would have been like, I mean, maybe you don't like that idea to overturn traditional halacha, but the Rishonim who lived in agriculture, in societies that is similar agriculture to the land of Israel, like Rambam living in Egypt, right? Or Rav Natan HaBavli, right? Rav Natan Avi Yeshiva, who lived in Bavel, right? Who lives in the same climate. If you'd asked me, and you said, look, major Rishonim living in the same climate as Chazal, who therefore have a likely better understanding of the agriculture that Chazal had, always thought it was segula and not avena. They always thought it was two-row barley and not oats. How controversial is this to say, you know, the Rambam was probably right, because the Rambam, A, is a major Rishon. We often busking the Rambam, and B, he lived closer to Israel, and the agriculture in Egypt was more similar to that of Israel than the agriculture in France. Big Chiddush, right? You know, however, I would have been wrong. This did become a huge controversy.
And I think the reason I wanted to do this topic is because the controversy highlighted really some fundamental methodological assumptions about how Psak works. So if you look in 14, Rabbi Yosef Efrati wrote an article, and he wrote, and just listen to his language, Chalila lehanifyad b'kabbalah uvema'aseh Shehem Amudim Dolimbara, God forbid that we should raise our hand against our accepted practice, right? Kabbalah, our tradition, and our accepted practice, which are the pillars of Psak. Vishtakua Dvarim Amorim Safek Bidavar Shinitkabel Bitzvoto Yisrael. Let the words of those who challenge the minhag that's been accepted amongst the Jewish people, let it be sunk. Kvar hiktim agon agodor mena merzbach zatzal lasei becharifut keneged meorer sefer Professor Yehuda Felix. Rav Yonah Merzbach already came out angrily and sharply against Professor Felix's book, Shekava zihuye v'shul kikveker haynu zihu mut'eh, who said that saying that Shibbolet Shul was kveker, which is obviously oats, but I think you could figure that out. Kveker oats. I think you could figure that one out. That wasn't kveker. I don't know if you could have read that, but that's what it is. Kveker oats is wrong. Now, this to me is really, I'll be honest, it's weird. To me, it's weird. Because I'm willing to accept the argument that minhag is really important in Psak, and Kabbalah, Mesorah, is really important in Psak, and therefore we shouldn't just let, I'm willing to hear it and say that archaeology shouldn't just overturn it, or right? I don't know if I buy it, but I'm willing to hear it. Right? I think I've been too influenced by Rav Schechter. And Rav Schechter is, like, totally not on this plane at all. Rav Schechter is just like, you know, sure, if archaeology says something and it overturns what we knew, great. Right? Like, he's pretty much okay with this. Right? Both to institute new practices, to overturn old ones. Right? Most famously, right, that's why he supports Tchelet. Right? Because he said, I don't know. So, the Mitzvah, right? And he said, yes, Rabbi Soloveitchik has a Mesorah from his family, that Tchelet needs a Mesorah. Right? You can't bring back Tchelet without a direct tradition. So archaeology doesn't matter. And Rav Schechter said, meh, why not? Right? If we have good archaeological reasons to believe that it is, that the Murex trunculus is Tchelet, so bring it back. Right? Why not? I don't understand why you need it. At the worst, it's a Sefik D'Oraisa. Right? And then you should do it. Right? And, you know, you can see. I don't know if you can see. Right? But I have Tchelet on my sisters because, you know, that compels me. Right? I don't know. Maybe I just hung around YU enough. You know, I don't know. But to be fair, it's not everyone at YU. Right? Right? Willig is less like that. But I'll be honest. I find this surprising because if you think about the methodology that's going in here, it's not just saying that we follow Mesorah and Minhag against science, right? It's prioritizing a Ashkenazi Minhag that's developed in the last few hundred years to follow Rashi against the Rambam, against a Sephardi tradition, right? It's like, It's making a very radical claim, which is that the Mesorah of our particular community in a sliver of history, in like a few hundred year sliver of history, is so strong as to what? To mean that we are not allowed to rely on the Rambam? I mean, that sounds radical to me, right? And one of the things I think about a lot is this notion of like Ashkenazi and Sephardi in the modern world. He doesn't say it explicitly, but my guess is that part of what motivates this is like a very strong identity vision of Judaism, where for him, right, for Rav Efrati writing, it's like the Ashkenazi Achronim have all said this, right? And if you really think that like Ashkenazi and Sephardi are like hard definitions to your identity, so then it doesn't matter that 800 years ago there were major Rishonim who had different traditions, that then maybe there are other halachic traditions elsewhere in the Jewish world, right? If you really think that halachically Ashkenazi is like real in some deep metaphysical way, So then, sure, the only Mesorah and Minhag that matters to you is like Mishneh Berurah Chai Adam, right? Like the Ashkenazi tradition in Europe for the last 200, 300 years, right? And it reveals a very strong methodological bias, but honestly, it's one to me that is very odd. Because, first of all, like I said, even if I was willing to accept that you aren't allowed to just take science to overturn Mesorah, I just don't see this as overturning Mesorah, which by saying we should follow the Rambam and one sheet and the Aruch. I mean, really? And as much as you think that there's, like, we're Ashkenazim or Sephardim or whatever, does that mean that, like, the other traditions that are very much alive are off, right, out of our calculus? I mean, I find both of those assumptions very odd. Right? For reasons that I've developed elsewhere. But I find them very odd. Now, admittedly, there were some... Now, and, you know, Ray Cohn here notes that in the end of the day, Rav Moshe, Rav Yashiv, Rav Soloveitchik, all did reject Professor Felix. He notes that there were people who disputed him on academic grounds. So, for example, Dr. Monk suggests that what differentiates the five grains from the others is not gluten, but beta amylase, which oats do contain, which allows the fermentation to occur before the proteases, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, cause the grains to go rancid. Raya Frati and Raya Kestenbaum reported they tested oats and have found that they can become chametz and do not become rancid. Now, I will point out this happens to be a mistake, okay? Most oat flour that you buy in the store will rise, but do you know why it rises? Because it has added gluten, okay? Because it won't rise without it. It's just not possible. It just doesn't. It does something similar to rising, but it doesn't rise the same way. It's like, have you ever tried making rice bread? Right? Okay. The Gemara says that rice, right? The Gemara says, quotes a machlokas, between the Chachamim, Riochem, and Nuri, is rice chametz or not? Riochem and Nuri says it is. And the Yerushalmi says, well, why didn't they just check? So then the Yerushalmi says something very weird. Al ikir b'dikata haim cholkim. They're arguing, they checked, and they're arguing about the results of their experiment. So you just tell me, and that's weird, just run another experiment. Run enough experiments until you're convinced. So one of my chavrus says, right, Alex Tikkin once pointed out to me, We did an experiment. We did this. And eventually we figured out, it was his insight, but we did the experiment, and I'm totally convinced it's Trot and the Gemara. So here's the thing. Rice actually will rise. Pure rice flour will rise. But why will it rise? Because it has a gluten as a protein, which creates a crystal lattice structure, and that's what gives it, right, that's what makes it rise. That's what catches the air. Rice has a similar protein, which will do that also, except it's not nearly as strong as gluten. So, when you first make the dough, it will rise. But if you shake it at all, or more importantly, you bake it, it will collapse because it can't handle heat and it can't handle movement because it'll let it rise, but it's weak. So we can't hold it when stressors are put on it. So what my chavrusa argued was that the machlokes, when the Yerushalmi says al ikir b'dikatayim cholkim, it doesn't mean that they ran experiments and they just argued what the results were. Rice did rise. It just can never be baked risen. So the question was, is that called rising? On the one hand, it does technically rise. But on the other hand, it doesn't rise in such a way that it could ever create bread. Oats are like that too. Oats have some sort of similar protein that will allow minimal rising, but it doesn't allow real rising unless you add gluten. It just doesn't. It's interesting, though, that in this you see that there's a second methodological point. Right? Because the first methodological point of Rav Efrati is this is Mesorah versus science. The second methodology is maybe not, but maybe science is split. And if science is split, then it's legitimate to go by our Mesorah. Those are actually two different methodological arguments, right? One is Mesorah wins no matter what the science might say. The other is
you know what, maybe we should revisit the science, but maybe science is also complicated. But nevertheless, despite the fact that I find it very, very odd that this became such a heated debate, it did, right? Because people ended up viewing it as Misora versus science, right? Even though, as I said, I find, right, what I find fascinating about it is that it was Misora from a very narrow perspective, right? Like, and I find it, I personally find it very hard to believe that someone can make a Misora argument, and say that something the Rambam said is pshat is like outside the Misora. I mean, that to me is a very radical, like localized version of Minhag and Misora that limits you to like 300 years of Ashkenazi pshat. I find that shocking. I really do. Right? But it is telling to see that the fact that Rebbe Efrati, quoting Rebbe Yashiv and the like, doubled down so much on it, it reveals a lot. Right? This is why I wanted to do the topic, because the vehemence with which someone like Rebbe Efrati could insist on this really highlights assumptions about the way they think about Pesach, which are, to me, are really surprising, but are revolutionary in a certain sense. Okay, what does that mean, halacha l'maisa? So again, the post came in the end, as they say, because of Misora and the like, oats are definitely, unquestionably, one of the five grains, so the answer is obvious. Make oat matzo. But what if you're not convinced? So I tend to be partial to Rabbi Broid's conclusion here. I'll state outside. Rabbi Broid basically said as follows. By Dirabanans, it's legitimate to follow the possibility that oats really are the five grains. So like brachot, okay, maybe you can make mizonot, right? Rather than whatever you would make, hadama or shahakol. And maybe even hamotzi if you made bread. Maybe. For d'oraisa, he would definitely be machmir. And therefore, and I would agree with this, I don't think I would tell anyone, it's definitely not chametz, don't have it, you're allowed to eat it on Pesach, right? I don't think I would tell anyone you can have oat bread on Pesach, right? Because Rashi should at least be something to write to the Chumra. But what about oat matzah? So I tend to agree here with Rabbi Broid's conclusion, which is, if someone is actually celiac and cannot have any gluten whatsoever, so then what do they have to lose? Make oat matzah, meaning if they can't have any gluten. So if you pass them in the Rambam, then they're just onus. There's no possible way for them to fill the mitzvah. So they're onus, they're putter. And if you passing like Rashi, they can use oat matzah. So what do they have to lose from using oat matzah? Right? So you might as well use it. Now, I should note that, as I said before, Rav Schechter, who is much more open to bringing in scientific knowledge to, you know, gauge which halacha is right, I never talked to him about it, but it's like said around YU. I see no reason to assume that it's not true. He won't make mizonot on oats. For this reason. The way I heard it, again, I can't attest to it, I didn't ask him, was that, but this is what I do, is if you're having Cheerios, I get like all panicky when I have Cheerios, right? And like, this is like the panic of briskers, right? It's like, I will only have Cheerios if I'm also have, like, first I'll have like a pretzel and a, you know, a piece of something that's hadama, and have in mind to be yotze, and, you know, if I'm going to have a kezayit of it, enough to make a bracha krona, I try to have, you know, enough that I can make an alamich and burn a bozer from other things, because I'm just like, you know, I just can't deal with the suffix, right? I just can't. Okay. Now, right, Broid is a fascinating solution, though, for people who are not celiac, right? Celiac, they can't have it at all. Fine. They're totally allergic. That makes sense. What happens, some people have a gluten sensitivity. So they can have a little bit. But not a lot. So then what's the solution? So obviously the first solution off the bat is they should not be machmir like the Chazon Ishirim of matzah, right? That is a given, right? Take the most mekil shita that you can possibly find of a kezayit. Right? Willig once told me that if you had someone who was mamish sick, right, the absolute minimum that he would say is a kezayit is probably about a tenth of a machine matzah. Okay? That comes out to about an olive. Okay? But then, right, Broid has a very clever solution. Ray Cohn in his article also does, but he says it's not practical because the matzahs we're about to talk about are not made. That's true, but fine. And it goes like this. The Mishnah tells you in 16, Ha'otze isa min achitim u min ha'orez, im yish ba ta'am dagan chayevet v'chala, v'yotze ba adam yidei chovato v'pesach. If you make a dough out of wheat and rice, so if it still tastes like wheat, it's chayav and chala, and you can use it for matzah, and if not, not. This is a principle known as grera, that the wheat drags along the rice, and makes it into, for these purposes, rice. Now, what exactly does halacha mean? The Beis Yosef summarizes it. And he quotes, the ribbit rice, v'ushi yisham tam dagan, k'desh yochon tzayit b'chnech lefras, v'yochalenu. The ribbit says, you actually, that means, the only way to be yotzei is, if you actually, by the time you finish your matzah, had a kizayit of wheat. Meaning you made a matzah, all it's telling you is that, the wheat isn't butel to the rice, but you have to eat a lot of matzah such that you had a kezayit worth of wheat in kedei achilas pras. But the Ramban writes, shafilu ein sham kezayit achilas pras yotzei ba, v'vishmitin greirahu. Right, the Ravid says this Gemara is just teaching you, the Mishnah is just teaching you that the wheat is not butel, and therefore if you have enough wheat, you're yotzei. The Ramban says, no, there's a magic principle called greira, which is when you mix wheat and rice, the rice halachically integrates into the matzah, and you can be yotzei even if it's not wheat. It's only a little bit of wheat, as long as it tastes like wheat. So, what Rav Broyd suggests is the following. He says that the Mishnah Berurah and the Aruch HaShulchan say that B'shat HaTzchak, you can rely on the Ramban, right? Which is the majority of Rishonim. What percentage of the flour needs to be wheat flour for it to still have the taste of wheat? So he, right, Broyd asked food experts, and it turns out that if you have dough, which is even 10% wheat flour and 90% rice, it will still taste wheaty. Right? It'll taste like it has wheat in it. Which means that if you take the most mekil shita of a kezayit, and you say that because this is how the person can be mekayim the mitzvah, you say Ashkenazim can have kitniyot, right? You can override the minhag just for this purpose. And you make matzah out of this, you could basically be yotzei with 3 grams of wheat. That's essentially what it would come out, is that in the shear that you would need to be yotzei matzah, it would be 3 grams of wheat per matzah. And as he notes, yes, you'd have to make it on kitniyot, but that seems to be better than relying on oats, which is questionable. So therefore, his suggestion is for someone who has a wheat sensitivity, but not they're not celiac, is to make this 90% rice flour, 10% wheat flour, and then have the most minimum shear of a kezayit, which ends up being just a few grams. Again, most people don't make it, so it's a bit hard, but in theory, this would be a better solution. Rav David Cohen does quote it in his article. He just says that it's not practical because most people don't make it. Obviously, for some people who have even less extreme wheat sensitivities, then they could just have the minimum shear. Right? Meaning some people can have a little bit more, and obviously that would be an acceptable solution as well. He also notes that maybe if you can only have one kezayit, if your stomach can only handle one kezayit, so then you should have it for Motzi Matzah. You should skip Motzi Matzah and only for Avikomen, because Avikomen might be more important. And again, as I noted, obviously as a Rosh Weiss notes, you should have the most lenient opinion of a kezayit. Okay, there is a little bit of an afkamina in 20 and 21 in terms of what bracha you make.
We're not going to have time to do it, but so let me summarize what you have here in 22 to 30. All of this assumes, or again, that it's possible to tell someone, even though he's getting a little bit of a stomachache, as long as it's not going to, you know, kill him or her, that they do have to have wheat on Pesach. Now, where does that come from? So this is what I gave you in the end, is that there's a huge machloket poskim, the extent to which doing a mitzvah requires you even to accept becoming a little bit sick. The source for this really is the Gemara in Nedarim, which says that Rabbi Yehuda had such a hard time dealing with alcohol that simply from having the four kosot on Pesach, he had a headache from Pesach until Shavuot. And based on this, Shulchan Aruch notes that even if someone doesn't normally have wine because it hurts them, they have to push themselves for the Arba Kosot. Which as the Mishnah Berurah notes, this means it gives you a headache. Not if you're going to be sick, like you're going to be bedridden. If you're going to be bedridden, so then you're patur. But if it just gives you a headache, and the equivalent might be a little bit of a stomach ache, there's good reason to say that you're chayav. Now, there's a bit of a discussion that maybe part of the discussion in Arba Kosot is about Chirut or not. But right, there is good evidence that even being sick, or minorly sick, is not enough to potter you. Really sick, you would be potter. Moshe Feinstein argues if you'd be extremely sick, you'd be potter, because since the rule is that you only have to give up a fifth of your wealth to perform a mitzvah, if you're going to be super sick, that's equivalent to losing a fifth of your wealth, because bodily pain is worse than monetary pain. But again, a minor stomach ache, the poskim do seem to assume, and again, it's a bigger topic, which we don't have time, but many poskim at least assume that a minor sickness would not exempt you from the mitzvah. And if that's the case, right, for someone who's not a celiac, but just has a minor sensitivity to gluten and will have a little bit of a stomach ache, having the minimum shear. So obviously you can have the minimum shear, but there's good reason to believe that they would still be chayav to have something. Rav Asher Weiss's summary of this, if you look in 30, is that if someone's a chol yesh bo sakana, if it's going to endanger his life, obviously he doesn't have to do it. Obviously. If he's going to lose a limb or something like that, also doesn't have to. Chol she'ein bo sakana, like you're actually going to be bedridden, he thinks you're patur, but you're allowed to be mekayim the mitzvah midat chasidut if you want. But if you're just going to get a little bit of a stomach ache or a headache, the simple read of Shulchan Aruch is that you are chayav. And therefore, he argues that if someone has a weak sensitivity, a gluten sensitivity, but not celiac, and is only going to have a little bit of a stomach ache, so obviously talk to your doctor, figure out how bad it's going to be. But if it's just going to be a passing stomach ache, presumably you really are chayav. So like I said, it's a much bigger topic for another time. But there is good reason to believe that a minor stomach ache and the like is not going to be enough, which is why someone can't just get away by saying, oh, I have a, you know, gluten sensitivity, and then just, you know, get out of it that easily. It's not that simple. It's really a much more complicated topic. But unfortunately, we won't get to it in depth today, but I gave you at least some of the key sources here. Okay?